issues, and then they are able to get another child through this rehoming process. That's pretty outrageous.
We've seen cases where children go missing via the internet. They say they're going to a family member and they go missing. They're in the paper. Human trafficking, that these cases set up a very easy scenario for human trafficking of children. You have an individual decide he's going to or she's going to adopt these children, and they get them in their home, and where they go after that, there's no tracking. There's no oversight. There's no follow-up. Unlike if you were to adopt a dog, you might have some follow-up care. You might have a microchip. And I'm not ever suggesting children should be microchipped, but there is no follow-up. We never know what happens to these children.
Because of the experience, honestly, I went through, now I feel like I might not be a good mother, which is so sad because someday I want to be a mother. I always, when I was a little girl, I played with dolls and stuff before this stuff happened to me. But now I'm experiencing not so good things as in what I seen. A mom can be very mean and very hard on a kid. So now I experience that. I feel I'm a fear that I might not be a good mother. I want my future be happy. I want to be happy and someday bring all my family, my mom, my sister, my brothers, all live in one big house.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
President Joe Biden said Tuesday, 3rd of August, he believes New York Governor Andrew Cuomo should resign following the release of a damning report concluding that the governor sexually harassed nearly a dozen women over a 7-year period and created a toxic workplace. The article you're about to hear has been written by Lisa Hagen, a politics reporter for U.S. News and World Report. The piece is titled, Biden Calls on Cuomo to Resign After Damning Report on Sexual Harassment, Toxic Workplace. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 3rd of August, he believes New York Governor Andrew Cuomo should resign following the release of a damning report concluding that the governor sexually harassed nearly a dozen women over a 7-year period and created a toxic workplace. As allegations surfaced against Andrew Cuomo in late 2020 and earlier this year, President Biden said back in March that the New York Democrat should step down if the claims are proven true, adding that he'd likely be prosecuted. Shortly after the report's publication on Tuesday morning, a defiant Andrew Cuomo pushed back against the claims in video remarks, making it clear he would not voluntarily leave his post. Following his scheduled remarks about COVID-19 vaccination efforts, President Biden was asked by reporters whether he stands by his remarks from March about Cuomo resigning. He briefly said he stands by that recommendation, noting that he hasn't read the report and only knows the end result. Biden confirmed that he hasn't spoken with the New York governor since the publication of the report. "I stand by that statement, yes," President Biden said on Tuesday afternoon from the White House East Room. When pressed if Cuomo should be impeached if he doesn't step down, Biden added, "Let's take one thing at a time here. I think he should resign." The report conducted by independent investigators appointed by New York Attorney General Letitia James's office said Andrew Cuomo sexually harassed 11 women between 2013 and 2020. The report said Cuomo broke state and federal law as well as his office's own policies and engaged in unwanted touching, in addition to making inappropriate comments to women. The women some named and others referred to anonymously included former and current staffers and state employees, as well as a state trooper who at the time worked on his security detail. As a part of a five-month investigation, Cuomo provided sworn testimony and denied the claims made by four women and generally denied touching anyone inappropriately. In his testimony and during his public remarks on Tuesday, the governor said he often hugs and kisses people on the cheek. He testified he may have kissed some staffers on the lips, but denied those claims from one of the unnamed executive assistants and former staffer, Lindsay Boylan, who went public with her claims last year. Investigators characterized Cuomo's pushback as blanket denials, while also noting that his memory of events stood in stark contrast to the strength, specificity, and corroboration of the complainant's recollections. "What matters to me at the end of the day is getting the most done I can for you," Andrew Cuomo said in response to the report. "I will not be distracted from that job." President Biden isn't the only high-profile Democrat or elected official in Washington to call for Andrew Cuomo's resignation. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, New York's two senators, reiterated calls for him to step down. Three congressmen from the state, including House Democratic Caucus Chairman Hakeem Jeffries, also said Andrew Cuomo should resign. The investigation has found that the governor engaged in abusive behavior towards women, including subordinates, creating a hostile work environment, and violated state and federal laws. Hakeem Jeffries said in a joint statement with Democratic Representative Tom Suozzi and Representative Gregory Meeks, "The time has come for Governor Andrew Cuomo to do the right thing for the people of New York State and resign." Also, state assembly Democrats who hold the majority in the chamber held an emergency meeting on Tuesday, 3rd of August, to discuss the matter, with a pre-scheduled meeting on impeachment set for Monday. The state Senate president, Democrat Andrea Stewart-Cousins, reiterated her call for Andrew Cuomo to resign. New York City's likely next mayor, Eric Adams, called on the assembly to impeach Cuomo if he refuses to resign. Meanwhile, in a defiant and defensive taped statement, the 63-year-old Andrew Cuomo denied some of the allegations against him and said other behavior or statements were misinterpreted and hinted at political motives by would-be rivals. It was a classic Cuomo response from the famously bombastic and aggressive politician. Not only did Cuomo deny he had done anything wrong, but he cast himself as a victim, saying the entire episode had been a hard and painful episode for me and my family. It now appears that Governor Andrew Cuomo is virtually alone in his opinion that he should keep his job. Calls for his immediate departure are mounting.
Start Your Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Saving Capitalism, directed by Jacob Kornbluth. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Clive Menzies, who is involved in Critical Thinking, a research and educational project which seeks to understand how the political economy works and identify levers for change. Now, Saving Capitalism is a documentary that explores the reasons why the economic system that once made the US strong is suddenly failing. The film is a clear-eyed examination of a political and economic status quo that no longer serves the people, exposing the powerful alliances between Washington and Wall Street, as well as the extreme wealth disparity in the US. And starring Robert Reich, and whose book inspired the film, served as Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, takes us through the US's fragile democracy and its fight for survival, and argues that it's up to ordinary US citizens to change the rules.
There's a huge amount of anger and frustration. So many people desperately wanting to be heard. And nobody is listening. It's up to us to change the rules.
We are a two-tiered society composed of a few winners and a larger group of Americans left behind.
And it's getting worse and worse and worse.
Thank you very much. Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under President Clinton.
I want to go to places where I could actually interact.
I really want to talk to people about their lives. Yes, that's true. As income and wealth go to the top, so does political power.
People don't trust that our society is working for most people. Nobody in our society, the richest nation in the history of the world, should be working and not making it.
The old assumption has been that the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, something's way off all over the country. Right, left, everybody. Something's wrong.
This is about power. It's about reclaiming our democracy and reclaiming our economy.
This country is upside down, and it's not working for 99% of our society anymore.
We are at a critical turning point in this country, and this is dangerous. The only way forward is to get organized and politically active.
New York now! New York now!
Democracy is a very fragile thing.
It's now up to the next generation.
First of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. So I found this film an enlightening watch, and I think it offers an effective crash course on US inequality, particularly on the economy. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
It's a really easy film to watch. It's made in a kind of gentle, smoothly edited, it carries you along, it's intriguing, it's gripping. And Robert Reich is a really great central character. He's kind of warm and a little bit scruffy and impish and funny.
Very entertaining to watch.
He's very entertaining, and the things he says are incredibly pointed and they grab your attention. The central topic of the film is really strong. I don't know, I mean, the title is a little bit, I think, misleading almost, because I think it will put off a lot of viewers. Mm-hmm. But the central idea of the fact that, the economic system in America is tilted so heavily toward corporations, is a really important message that I think needs to get out there. And so you're watching it, you feel your blood starting to boil. It's one of those documentaries that starts making you more and more angry, mm-hmm. even as it kind of gives you some ideas of the way forward or what's likely to happen.
And so. Clive, if I could turn to you, as a political economist, what's your take on Saving Capitalism?
My first reaction was that it was something of a political pitch. And it was very articulate, very well done. It articulated the symptoms extremely well. Whether Reich's prescription for the remedy is appropriate, I would question, because it's the pendulum swinging back and forth. And Reich emerged in the 60s and 70s, and he seems to hark back to that as some sort of golden era, but that was just a temporary blip post-war in this long war of attrition, which is effectively what they managed in the 60s and 70s, both in the UK and in the US, was some sort of social contract, which was a renegotiation of the terms of slavery. Mm-hmm. But slavery certainly wasn't abolished, and I'm not sure that the thrust of this film gets us any closer to abolishing slavery, which is effectively what this system is.
Well, I suppose this documentary could only cover so much ground in 90 minutes or so, but I'm just wondering, as someone who's not familiar with the economy, does this serve as a good introduction to get to grips with what capitalism is and the arguments that Reich makes?
Yeah, and I thought it was quite interesting. I was making notes as the film unfolded, and I was writing down names that I thought ought to have been mentioned, and sure enough, they come in. He mentions Robert Rubin as Treasury Secretary. And you look at the sort of Clinton administration dynamic, and to some extent, Reich was in there as the pigeon. And he fought very hard, and he said, my only regret was I didn't push harder. The irony is, he probably doesn't recognize that he couldn't have pushed harder, or he would have been out, or he wouldn't have got anywhere anyway. So I think it's, for all his 5 decades of experience, I'm not sure he's learnt the game sufficiently. He didn't realise the shark-infested pool in which he was operating.
Mm. Now, we see his character sort of, and his character progression throughout the documentary, actually, and how sort of down-spirited he becomes, but also hopeful as well. But Rich, just wanted to ask you, for viewers not well-versed with the economy, do you think this film serves as a good introduction then?
Well, it's very interesting. It's obviously from a particular point of view, but what it does explain in the way that I haven't heard explained quite so simply and straightforwardly is how the whole economy was founded on a principle that was flawed, mm-hmm. basically tilted toward the wealthy and corporations right from day one, mm-hmm. and how people with power just consolidate their power. So it's only gotten worse over the last 250 years, and it's just now the general average person in America has no power really politically. Which is quite a shocking thing to say, but when you think about it, it's true. And you look at the way laws are being passed and the way the government is behaving, mm-hmm. That's kind of how it's working. And but you see little people taking bites out of it. So I think the system has room to correct itself, and that helps. While you're watching the film, it helps you not be completely hopeless.
There's strong arguments indeed made in this film, and of course aided by great animation sequences and graphics as well.
Yeah.
Intuition right now is clear. Something's wrong. All over the country, right, left, everybody. Something's way off.
The old assumption has been the division is Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah, that's
but what we're beginning to see is that it's actually anti-establishment versus establishment.
Yeah.
It's people who don't want the big money and the crony capitalism versus the crony capitalists.
Yeah.
Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, there's going to be disagreement on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But if you could come together on these fundamentals.
It's fine with me. You're at a deeper level, right? You've been teaching economics and all that for 30 years. I used to use your book.
Used to use my book?
I used to use it.
Can
what
we just make, can you?
And
can
I have a book out, too.
Can we get that again? Congressman, what do you think of the title?
Yeah, I know. It surprised me a little bit coming for you, but in a pleasant way. I think you and I are united on we can do this in the right way, ethics and capitalism together, and we'll save the country.
I think what's interesting about this documentary is that Reich manages to put Republicans, both them and Democrats, around tables and get them to agree with him actually on this issue. And do you think Reich has all that political authority to do that?
Well, I mean, he's Democrat, he's very kind of entrenched in that world. But I like the fact that he's looking beyond that. He's looking at the point that this is about an establishment, anti-establishment thing. He talks about Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being anti-establishment. And they're opposite ends of the political spectrum. But basically what they were proclaiming or what they were trying to do was the same thing, just overthrow the system. And that's quite interesting. It's quite interesting that he's brought them both into the story.
Indeed, and I think at the time, we see Trump there. It was early elections when they were filming this documentary, and it was the front runners were Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. But I don't think they could have foreseen that Trump would have won.
Well, no, nobody foresaw that, did they?
No, not at all. But I think the argument made in the film, though, is perhaps this anti-establishment sort of notion is that Trump was bringing corporate power to influence political power, which, of course, this documentary highlights. Would you agree with that, Clive?
Undoubtedly. And we've seen what's happened since. Trump has populated his administration with Goldman Sachs alumni and the usual suspects. So the system is so, corporate influence is so embedded in the system. And Reich talks about lobbying, but lobbying is just the sort of the visible tip of the iceberg. It's basically embedded in the whole superstructure.
Well, the tax law that they passed was just purely aimed at helping corporations.
Exactly. So you know, the civil, what we call the civil servants in this country, the administrative engine is fully embedded with corporate interests, and the idea that changing the figurehead from red to blue or Democrat to Republican or vice versa is going to change anything. We saw it with Obama. We've seen it with Trump. You know, and you know, should this be a platform for another Bernie Sanders, it'll be exactly the same story. One has to question the system rather than the political flavor. And I think, frankly, I found that conversation with the Republican senator somewhat naive, really.
Oh, so Rich, what do you think about actually the arguments made in this documentary about the relationship between political power and the economy and corporate interests? Does it make strong arguments bringing the two together?
Well, it does. I mean, it makes very strong arguments that the people who have the money have the power. It's kind of obvious. But it's quite creepy to watch a film like this where they explain how that plays out through the lobbying, through the passage of laws, through financial contributions to campaigns, and then getting, you know, favors on the back end of that. And you realize that the system is just, it's just kind of eating itself, and it's very much it's perpetuating that corporate power and that kind of inequality to where the, you know, the middle class is just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
So perhaps not surprising, but very telling.
It's not surprising, but it kind of helps, it helps you understand what's happening, because everybody knows this is happening, but nobody really gets why or how, or, you know, how it's affecting them. And this kind of helps, it helps you understand it a little bit better, and perhaps helps you, gives you a voice. I mean, that's what this kind of film does. It might get people to stand up and say, wait a minute, something has
it's
to happen.
It's an empowering documentary.
Yeah.
And
there's a moment in the film where they mention that this happened 100 years ago, which is really interesting. The exact same thing. And there was a huge backlash. The public came out protest. They elected all new people. They passed all these laws, which have pretty much all been overturned now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It's interesting that, you know, we're kind of repeating history. Mm-hmm. So
I would like to touch on that actually a bit more in the next section.
I've been working at McDonald's for 4 years. I work at the drive-thru window. I get paid $12.55 per hour. I make about $1,200 a month. $900 goes straight to rent, and I have to pay for gas. And then my phone bill, I end up with nothing. I sometimes have to go to the payday loan and get a loan on my paycheck in order to make it on time and don't get any late fees and try to make ends meet.
Nobody should be working full-time and not making it. Nobody in our society, the richest country, the richest nation in the history of the world, should feel as frightened and anxious and as insecure as so many people do today.
And Rich, what did you make of these sort of contributions to the documentary, these stories, the McDonald's worker, and also we saw Farmer in the documentary also?
I think it's just an example of the thing that a lot of people are feeling, and it's regardless of what your political views are, that feeling like, why is life getting worse? Why is my paycheck not going as far as it went 5 years ago? Why do I feel like I'm earning less money and everything costs a lot more? Mm-hmm. There's something wrong here. When the wealthy people are just getting richer and richer and richer and richer, and they're buying cars and houses and they're living, and they're talking about how booming the economy is, and I'm not feeling that. And those stories reflect that. reflect something that almost all of us feel, unless we're in that top 1%, I think.
And Clive, I want to ask that question that Robert Reich raises. Why is it that people who are working full-time are struggling to make ends meet in one of the richest countries in the world?
There's an inevitability in where we've got to. I referred earlier that the post-war consensus did actually give people some semblance of a decent life. They were working hard, but they were being well rewarded. They didn't have to have multiple jobs. But I think that respite was only temporary, and there's a much deeper underlying problem than what the documentary brings out. But what the documentary, the power of the documentary, is that it begins people on a journey of understanding. It may not go the whole way, but it certainly introduces concepts that may be totally alien to them. And having these stories actually puts them into the context of their own lives. But there is an inevitability to this idea that things get worse and worse, because essentially the wealth is sucked to the top. And there are very simple mechanisms that drive that. And it's to do with theft of what should belong to everyone, land, resources, etc., and usury, because it's just a straight interest on money. It's just a straight wealth transfer mechanism.
She said she had to take payday loans.
Exactly.
And of course,
so that just exacerbates
debt.
It. Mm. So this process, in days gone by, we had debt jubilees. And basically everything would be forgiven, we'd start afresh, and the system would reset. 1929 was a reset, and that's why all those laws were so effective, because it reset the economy. We had a crash in 87, we had a crash in 98, we had a crash in 2000, we had one in 2008. We've not had a reset. All that's happened is that the Fed has continued to pile more money into the system, which has done nothing to alleviate the hardship of people like that lady at McDonald's. But it's gone into asset price. It's driving more of the wealth to the top. So the system needs a reset. And the fear is that the reset will be much too painful. It'll be like the 1930s depression. Mm-hmm. And if we want to avoid that, we have to think in a different way. Mm-hmm. That doesn't come out of the film. But if this starts people on a journey of
understanding. At least it's a good starting point. Yeah,
yes. I think it does a very good job of opening the door to concepts that people probably don't think about, although they feel them, as Rich says, on a daily basis in their own lives.
And Rich, before we move on, I just quickly wanted to touch on the point you made about Reich earlier on, about him. You can tell, you get a sense from the documentary, he's trying really hard. He's been a senior political figure in America, but it doesn't seem like he's getting anywhere, and you can see his spirits sort of go down throughout the years.
But it's just, you know, watching the system get worse and worse, and he talks about seeing the seeds of what we're seeing now, seeing it back in the 80s, you know, and realizing that this was going to happen. It was just going to get worse and worse. And
but you can feel that sense of frustration from him.
Yeah,
also.
You do see him getting frustrated. And you saw him, like, in the clips from when he was working with Clinton, and he's trying to change things. And, of course, he can't, because every bill he proposes is heavily compromised by exceptions and things, and which just basically made the situation even worse. Mm-hmm. So you do watch him kind of getting more and more demoralized, and then this film is basically his journey around the country to try to make sense of that and work a way forward. It is, like you say, it's an opening of the door to the theme. It doesn't really get that deep into it, but it helps you understand in a way that you kind of makes you think, and you think, oh, maybe I do need to pay attention to the candidates more when the next election comes around, and pay attention to what they're saying.
Even in the insurance provider that I have, I was informed that they no longer cover chemo drugs fully. And so we were told by a medical social worker that we could potentially receive a bill for thousands of dollars. With the four drugs that I take for chemotherapy, the total comes out to about $3,000 a month per treatment. But for me, that's about 3 months of income just for one round of treatment. What is the alternative to receiving your chemotherapy drugs? There isn't one. So whatever the cost is, you have to pay it.
You and I and everybody else in this country pays more for pharmaceuticals than any citizens of any advanced nation.
So you would think medicine should save people, not bankrupt them. Rich, what impression did you get of the pharmaceutical industry from this documentary?
Personally, you know, I live in the UK, and our government right now is trying to create that system here, which is terrifying to me. That's terrifying.
Increasing privatization.
Yeah, and making it so that we have to pay for everything, even though we already pay for it. Mm-hmm. I find that really disturbing. But, this clip is part of a bigger point in the film, because he talks about how Americans pay more for airfares, they pay more for, you know, virtually everything. Internet access, mobile phones, everything is more expensive because of these special interests that have created laws that basically give them bigger profits. And that these companies are regulated outside of America because they're considered public utilities and they're not allowed to have obscene profits. Because they're utilities, they're something everybody has to have. And it's a bigger point in the film, is that these essential services shouldn't be allowed to make, you know, obscene profits make people poor, basically.
Would you agree with what Rich said? Your thoughts on the sort of free-for-all economy?
On the pharmaceutical industry specifically, I think there's a deep misunderstanding of how we got here. One of the original Rockefellers was a snake oil salesman, and he basically, through endowing universities, medical schools, and health facilities, basically alienated the whole idea of natural medicine. That lady said there's no alternative. There are alternatives, actually effective alternatives. And the pharmaceutical industry is not about curing people, it's about making money. Mm-hmm. And if people get better, that's a side benefit. It's certainly not the main thrust. So the cost is part of this, but it's actually the industry itself is perpetuating illness because it's profitable. And if you look at the insured model, and Rich mentioned what's happening in this country, you go back pre the start of this privatization regime, management costs in the UK were about 4%. In America, they're 20% with this insured model. We're now at the last, there was a secret study done. It's not been published. It's been available through leaks in various places. I think we're up to about 14%. But where we're heading to is 20% of the cost going into management. In other words, going back up to
that
the
is very
top.
Worrying indeed. And just as we end in near the end of the show, I'd just like to discuss one of the key messages of this documentary, which is the power of ordinary citizens, I suppose, to rise up and to challenge the 1%. Clive, do you think? I'm sorry, Rich. Do you think that this documentary ends on a hopeful note?
I mean, so many of these documentaries that make you angry end up by saying, you know, vote, use your vote, get out and protest. And, you know, that message has been going on for, we're 10 years into this economic system, this new world that we're living in, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. So
just your final thoughts on the film now.
Yeah, so I think the film helps raise issues that need to be raised, and we need to watch these kinds of films so that we understand what's going on. And maybe that will help us use our vote more wisely and get out and protest where it's effective. Mm-hmm. But it does kind of make you feel a little hopeless.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end it on a sad note there. But I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. Thank you very much. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you.
iRobbie English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Health tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the fourth episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this program, we are going to introduce to you one of Iran's leading hospitals in the city of Shiraz in southern Iran. Please stay with us. The city of Shiraz in southern Iran is one of the oldest cities in the country. The city is the provincial capital of Fars province. The city, which was called Tirazis and Shirazis in ancient Iran, is home to a number of very important and significant historical and archaeological sites and monuments such as Takht-e-Jamshid, also known as Persepolis, and Naqsh-e-Rustam. This beautiful city plays host to a significant number of local and foreign tourists every year, and the city has ample facilities and appropriate infrastructure to welcome large numbers of tourists and visitors from abroad. Also, the Shahid Dastgheib International Airport in the city of Shiraz is one of Iran's major airports and is regarded as a travel hub. Besides Shiraz's splendid tourist attractions and sightseeing, the city is also home to well-equipped and modern medical centers and hospitals that attract numerous local and international medical tourists every year. The city has always been the medical hub of southern Iran, attracting patients from far afield. Benefiting from a number of university hospitals, as well as private and state-run specialist medical centers, the city of Shiraz has been able to provide a wide spectrum of medical services to patients, such as organ transplants, eye surgeries, various kinds of plastic surgery, skin care, and dermatological treatment, cosmetic surgery, chemotherapy, and radioisotope therapy for curing various types of cancers, heart surgery, orthopedic surgery, infertility treatment, and in vitro fertilization, and so on. One of the biggest achievements of medical experts and specialists in the city of Shiraz has been organ transplants, and in particular, liver transplants. Liver is considered one of the most difficult organs of the human body to transplant. This activity was initiated in the city of Shiraz by Dr. Malik Hosseini, who is known as the father of liver transplants in Iran, making Shiraz the fulcrum of transplant surgery and liver treatment. Dr. Malik Hosseini performed the first ever liver transplant in Iran and West Asia region, gaining world fame and making him an outstanding figure internationally in the field of liver transplant. According to official records, the United States held the world record in 1993 and 1994. With 603 liver transplant surgeries being performed in that year in the U.S. However, that record was broken in 2017 through the tireless efforts of the medical specialists in Shiraz Abu Ali Sina Hospital, for the first time overtaking the United States and setting a new record by performing 638 liver transplant surgeries. Shiraz Abu Ali Sina Hospital, one of the most modern and well-equipped hospitals of its kind, is located 20 kilometers from the city center in Sadra, Newtown. This medical complex is considered the country's most important academic and medical center, boasting unrivaled facilities, equipment, and expertise, and all of it made by Iranian scientists, engineers, philanthropists, and charitable donors. The main building of Abu Ali Sina includes four blocks consisting of different sections of caring services, recognition services, lab, and treatment section. One of the hospital's achievements is launching a special section for hemodialysis with a capacity of admitting up to 240 dialysis patients every day. This feature has made Abu Ali Sina Hospital the main center for dialysis in Fars province and neighboring provinces of southern Iran. We earlier said that the International Department of Abu Ali Sina Hospital was launched in 2017, which provided professional treatment services for international patients at a very reasonable price. In addition to offering general treatments, different sorts of transplant surgery, including liver and kidney transplants, are performed at the hospital regularly. In the IPD section of the hospital, seven patients on average are admitted each day, who are provided with a special care from the time they are admitted until their discharge. Most international patients are from regional countries such as Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Tajikistan, Qatar, but there are also significant numbers of patients from various European countries. In the IPD department, there are translators, nursing staff, and highly experienced doctors who take care of patients and see to their every need. Dear listeners, for further information, you can go to the official website of Abu Ali Sina Hospital, that is www.otc-boali.com, or contact the International Department or IPD section of the hospital. The phone number is 0098-912-844-0803. Dear listeners, this has been the fourth episode of our series, Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4th, 2021. a televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. The Islamic Republic was an original idea. Therefore, this religious democracy, which was named the Islamic Republic, proposed by Imam Khomeini, is an original and purely religious idea. There should not be any doubt about this. Some people said that Imam borrowed the idea of holding elections, democracy, and other such ideas from Westerners because of some considerations. This is a completely groundless statement. The Imam that we knew and had worked with for many years, and the one that the people were familiar with, was not a person to forget about God's edict because of his standing on ceremony with someone or having certain considerations for this and that. If democracy did not have its roots in religion, and if it was not a godly phenomenon, Imam was not a person to do things by force. He would always confidently express his viewpoint. You have seen this in his life. The day when Imam brought up the issue of hijab, that women should be obliged to wear hijab, many people were opposed to it, even people close to Imam himself. One of the people close to Imam came to me saying, "Why is Agha saying this? What comment is that? You should go and ask him to change his mind." Of course, we had the same opinion as Imam did, but many were opposed to it. However, it was his opinion, and he determinedly brought it up, and it was a correct thing to say. There were other issues like this as well. Well, our magnanimous Imam carried out that religious innovation. He presented that progressive and novel idea, and that beautiful and astonishing interpretation of Islam, which had its roots in his deep understanding and clear ideas, thus bringing the Iranian nation, which had become used to tyranny for centuries, to the middle of the arena, helping them to be in charge of their own country and giving them the power to believe in themselves.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Round the world with reporters. Since the armed resistance against Indian rule began in Kashmir in 1989, New Delhi imposed a ban on Muharram processions in Indian-administered Kashmir, reasoning these processions might be used by the pro-freedom outfits to instigate the anti-India sentiments. Despite being challenged in the court of law, the ban remained intact. However, in a surprising move, New Delhi's administration this year lifted the ban. But more than appreciation, this decision has received criticism. Aga Said Rahula Mehdi, former member of Kashmir's Legislative Assembly in the past, has often contested the government's ban on Muharram processions. Mehdi says each time security agencies would give negative feedback.
While you have called off Amarnath Yatra, for which you mobilize entire security grid of the nation to enable that, and at the same time you didn't allow the Eid prayers for the last couple of years and this year including, and the best example to give is the Friday prayers at Central Jama Masjid, the central mosque of Grand Old Mosque of Srinagar, and it has been more than 100 Fridays that the prayers were not allowed or not allowed in that mosque. In while all this is happening, all of a sudden in isolation you give a permission to a procession for which you denied the permission for 30 years. So to me it is more questionable than it answers, and I have suspicions.
Mehdi says this decision by New Delhi has more to do with building a fake narrative and dividing the people of Kashmir on the communal lines.
I do not want the other section of the society to be suspicious about this section of the society, that they have the patronage of New Delhi, that they have the patronage of BJP government. If we suffer through it collectively, if we find ways to fight against it, to come out of it, we find the ways and go on those ways collectively. I do not want to see 10th Muharram procession after the gap of 30 years suddenly come up as a procession not for Imam Hussein but for the narrative building of a fake normalcy for Narendra Modi.
Locals too are apprehensive of this move amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Let them not play politics on this at least. This is a religious matter. If they think that allowing this procession will portray normalcy, they are risking lives. I don't think this was the right time to lift the ban. This simply means they don't care for the people.
After facing huge criticism, the government has revised the decision and passed the ball into the local administration's court. Since the decision of whether the Muharram procession be allowed or not has to be taken by district administrations, it remains to be seen how well they stage and whether people participate or not. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Few hours after President Qais Saied's decisions were published in the official gazette, Tunisian security forces arrested lawmaker Yassine Ayari to serve a two-month jail term handed down to him by a military court in 2018.
Everyone who erred must be held accountable, but a civilian may not be tried in a military court. Everyone who committed a crime must be arrested regardless of the circumstances of the trial.
Judge Bashir Al-Akrami was placed under house arrest after being accused of covering up terror-related files, obstructing investigations into them, and violating the law regarding the files of political assassinations. Hours later, security forces raided homes of other lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary, including Muhammad Al-Afis, Saifuddin Makhlouf, Abdul Latif Al-Alwi, and Maher Zaid, who was arrested and then released.
May God bless the president. We thank Qais Saied. We thank him for the decisions. Poverty and unemployment have overwhelmed us. I'm a Tunisian woman begging for money to buy medicine, and even my husband's salary has been seized.
About lifting the immunity of the deputies, I neither agree to nor oppose the decision. I support the enforcement of law.
On August 2nd, Tunisian security forces arrested member of parliament Faisal Tibini under summons issued by the first instance court in the state of Jandouba. Tibini was charged with spreading false news and offending others through social media. He also faces three other similar charges. Raids on arrested lawmakers to implement rulings issued by the military judiciary have opened the door to accusations against Saied, while leading political parties in Tunisia accuse the president of orchestrating a coup. Rights activists are concerned that the measures could open the door to further violations of citizens' freedoms.
Raids, arrests, and placing a deputy in prison to implement a ruling issued by the military judiciary opened the door to accusations against Saied, leading political parties in Tunisia accuse him of a coup. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
Following the latest Israeli escalation over the Gaza Strip that left more than 200 people dead, including women and children, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still recovering the psychological consequences of the war. Almost 600,000 students have suffered significant learning loss. In conjunction with the announcement of the Palestinian high school Tawjihi scores, 18 students from Gaza are not around to receive their scores as they were killed by the Israeli airstrikes. Khaled Al-Qanoua, a Palestinian student who was supposed to be receiving his high school scores this year, was killed by the Israeli airstrikes, leaving his family grieving.
I remembered Khaled today when I saw other students. Khaled was supposed to be with us today, celebrating his success and distributing sweets like other people. I saw Khaled's mates when they were having their exams, and I felt happy that Palestinians still insist on living their life even after wars and losses. I wish Khaled was here, but I believe that by knowledge, Palestinians will take revenge for Khaled, and his death won't go in vain.
The release of the test scores is usually met with parties, fireworks, and gifts, but due to the crisis in Gaza, many Palestinian students are not celebrating their success.
I have 3 of my sons who finished high school, and we celebrated with them. There were always atmospheres of happiness when my son succeeded. I wish Khaled was here so we could celebrate with him. He would have been something important. This time, the Israeli occupation stole my happiness. I feel his loss in all ceremonies. Whatever the Israeli regime does with its crimes and killings, we will remain patient, and we won't give up this land.
Subhi Abulauf, who has lost most of his family members in the Israeli airstrikes, is also among the students who were deprived from pursuing high school, as he is traumatized by his loss.
Those are really hard times for me while students are happy for their success, being around their families. I've lost my mom, my sister, and my home, and I couldn't continue going to school. There is no place for happiness. My cousin and I were supposed to be celebrating like our mates, but Tawfiq and my family are not around, and I'm not capable of continuing my education.
Many Palestinian students in the Gaza Strip who have lost their homes and family members are not able to carry on with their test for the time being due to the state of depression and instability they are in following the war over Gaza. Roba Shavit, Gaza.
A tearful farewell to Craig Murray from his family and supporters as the 62-year-old former diplomat hands himself in to Edinburgh police. In May, Scotland's second most senior judge accused Mr. Murray of deliberately risking jigsaw identification, an obscure term meaning of piece together. His posts could have led readers to identify women who made sexual assault allegations against former Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond, a charge Murray denies. But the UK's Supreme Court refused to hear his appeal last week.
This is an absolute disgrace. If they had to punish him, which I don't think they should have, because the evidence and the charges were so tendentious and so tenuous, they could have put him under home arrest or house arrest, put him on a tag. And if that wasn't enough, at least put him in an open prison. He is not a threat to society. The people who put him in prison are.